And on Mondays, we read your emails. We read from your emails. We have several from our segment last week about the seven states, including South Carolina and Arizona, that held Democratic races. That gives us a chance to invite Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor, back to the show to answer those questions and to update us on the caucuses that took place over the weekend. Thanks for joining us, Ken.
Thanks, Joe.
Okay. Let's start with some questions from our listeners after last week's coverage of the race for the Democratic nominee. From Paula Glazer, can a superdelegate such as Al Gore, who has already committed to a candidate, change which candidate he supports before the primary?
The answer is absolutely yes. That there are two types of delegates. There are pledged delegates and unpledged delegates. The pledged delegates are determined by the results of a state's primary. So, for example, if Missouri went for 58% for Kerry, Kerry gets 58% of those delegates, and so on. You need 15% minimum. That's a threshold to get the delegates. And unpledged delegates are basically what we call the superdelegates. They are Democratic Party officials, governors, members of Congress, members of the Democratic National Committee, party officials, party luminaries, such as Al Gore. They are not pledged. They are not committed to vote the way their state votes. So, in other words, Tennessee's primary is Tuesday, and supposedly Al Gore is still a resident of Tennessee, he could endorse whoever he wants. And so he is not pledged. Now, if Howard Dean drops out of the race before the convention, Al Gore is certainly free to switch. And you know something that's interesting about pledged delegates, too? They are not bound either. In a sense, like, for example, if Dick Gephardt had won the Iowa caucuses and won the most of the delegates, let's say, but if he's gone from the race, those delegates are still free to choose and change their mind as well.
I don't mean to put you on the spot, and if you don't know the exact numbers, that's fine. But I'm just wondering, what's the balance between pledged and unpledged delegates? Are they mostly pledged delegates?
Far more pledged delegates, yes. And you need 2,161 delegates to win the Democratic nomination.
It's a lot of delegates. Okay, let's go to our second email. Ken Grogan writes, "The term electability appeared out of nowhere. Where did it originate? Was it a reporter, a competing campaign, or somewhere else? And is electability the gravitas of the 2004 election?" And I guess before you tell us what electability comes from, what's gravitas come from?
Well, gravitas is in the past, in 2000, the question about George W. Bush, whether he had the gravitas to be president. He didn't have foreign policy experience, blah, blah, blah. That was the code word of 2000. Mm-hmm. 2004, it's electability, and this is very interesting. You have to go way, way back to the summer of 2003. If you can remember back that far, George W. Bush was a clear favorite to win re-election, and Howard Dean was the clear Democratic front-runner. I mean, that's such a silly word, especially when you look back what happened since then. But Howard Dean was the odds-on favorite for the nomination, but many Democrats said, yes, he has the passion, he has the money, he has the supporters, he has the internet, all that, but can he defeat President Bush? And the question that many Democratic insiders and party officials were saying that, no, we're nervous about that. So the electability question came up. So when we were polling voters in Iowa and New Hampshire, they were not talking about the war. They were not talking about the Bush tax cuts. They were talking about who could defeat President Bush, and suddenly electability became the key word.
Mm-hmm. You didn't make it up.
No. I checked. It's a real word.
Okay.
It's a real word.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like a real word. Yeah. Okay. Let's go to Suzanne Weinberg of Dummerston, Vermont, who wrote to say, "This campaign season has been radically affected by the phenomenon of winning begetting winning and losing begetting losing. This really seems counterproductive. I think all the primaries and caucuses should be on the same day nationwide. That gives all citizens in all parts of the country an equal say and puts all the candidates on equal footing as far as media exposure and campaign momentum go. How would this kind of change be initiated?"
Well, this is the kind of thing that comes up every 4 years, every time that, first of all, Iowa and New Hampshire lead the primaries and caucuses season every 4 years, and both states are lily white. They're 90% white, and a lot of people say that, look, this is not representative of the country. Why not have a state like Missouri or Michigan with labor, with African-American voters and persons of color? You don't have that in Iowa and New Hampshire. It's not fair to start like that. Michigan tried to do that last year. They tried to move up, but the DNC said, no, we can't do that. There were too many labor backers in Michigan who already like Howard Dean, and since Howard Dean was leading in Iowa and New Hampshire, why rock the boat? Why rock Labor's vote? Terry McAuliffe, the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, has said, and this is silly because we hear this every 4 years, he said, we will have a commission to look at this for possible changes for 2008. The problem with having every state at the same time, of course, is that then you have to be very, very wealthy candidate to survive. I mean, how does a Dennis Kucinich or an Al Sharpton or somebody like that survive when all 50 states are voting in the primaries at the same time? You'll have to raise tens of millions of dollars in advance. I mean, as it is now, you have to raise tons of money, but the process would go on much earlier, start much earlier than it does now if you do 50 states at once.
I'd like to invite our listeners to join us if they have questions. The number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK or 8255, and you can always email us at totn@npr.org. Ken, one thing that strikes me, though, is are we in a situation today where we are similar to what you were describing from the summer of 2003, where we will laugh at the conventional wisdom that says Kerry's got it locked up, it's all over, bar the shouting. Is Kerry in the same place that Dean was, and is it possible that we could be just as wrong about Kerry as we are about Dean?
Well, certainly,
we were about Dean.
Look, everything is possible, as President Howard Dean would tell you. Right. You know, anything is possible. But here's the difference. Howard Dean had this gigantic lead when no votes were being cast, when either the media or the polls, wherever, were anointing front runners. Whereas now we've heard from 10 states already, 11 states, starting in Iowa on January 19th. We've gone through the mini Super Tuesday from last, when we had 7 states last Tuesday. We have 2 more primaries on tomorrow. The voters at least are having their say, and if you look at what the results show so far, John Kerry is in a position where he is not because he was anointed by the media, not because Terry McAuliffe and the Democratic bigwigs wanted him, it's because the voters were choosing him. And the fact that Kerry has won Iowa and New Hampshire and won a overwhelming majority of the states so far, that's why he's in the position he's in now.
Okay, let's review the weekend's events. John Kerry won all 3 races over the weekend in Michigan, Washington State, and Maine. How exactly did things play out in those states?
Well, this is part of that electability question that we just heard. Theoretically, you would say that John Kerry would have problems in a state like Michigan. He supported NAFTA. Michigan lost some 200,000-300,000 jobs in the past 3 years. Much of it has been laid on the doorstep of NAFTA. Kerry supports higher fuel efficiency requirements, which is not a popular position in a state like Michigan. So you think that Kerry, this would not be fertile territory for him. But because Democrats, again, as I said, want so badly to defeat President Bush, he seemed to be the candidate that the Democrats were talking about. As a matter of fact, if you look at Howard Dean and John Edwards and Wesley Clark, the other major Democrats, they basically left Michigan. They said, we don't have a shot, which is so remarkable, given the fact that it's the biggest state so far to vote, 128 delegates, and yet they felt that Kerry had such an overwhelming lead, despite holding positions that would be anathema to Michigan voters.
And did he sweep the board? I mean, is that one of those states where he gets everything if he wins?
No. Democrats, going back to 1972, Democrats, it's proportional. So if John Kerry got 51% of the vote in Michigan, he gets 51% of the delegates. But again, in a 5-candidate race, you know, we still have Al Sharpton, Dennis Kucinich, Clark Edwards, Howard Dean. To get 51% in a field like that just shows the strength of John Kerry.
And Washington State and Maine, less of a surprise going for Kerry.
Well, again, these should have been Howard Dean states, and once upon a time they were. Washington State is known for the protests on trade. Again, it has a liberal electorate, Seattle, very liberal. Jim McDermott, the congressman there, was a Howard Dean supporter. Once upon a time, this was thought to be Howard Dean country, but again, there's a John Kerry steamroller that seems to be taking the voters along with him.
I'd like to take just a quick moment here to remind people that you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. In Washington, I'm Joe Palca for NPR News. Ken, where has Dean got to still make his stand? I think he's talked about, was it Wisconsin next week, that's his make or break?
Exactly.
Although make or break is make or break for next Tuesday.
Well, Howard Dean says that he has to win Wisconsin on February 17th for him to remain in the race, which is remarkable because let's not assume anything, but if Howard Dean does not win before Wisconsin, that means he would have gone 0-16 going into Wisconsin. For somebody, never in the history of presidential politics has somebody gone 0-16 and gone on to win the nomination. And so he is putting all his eggs in one basket. Perhaps he survives if he wins Wisconsin, but if he doesn't, then he's already drawn the line in the sand. If he doesn't win Wisconsin, Howard Dean ceases to exist as a serious candidate.
We have an email here from Nicole in Florida who writes, can you please explain to me what a delegate's role is at the convention? If a candidate wins X amount of delegates during the primaries, are those delegates sent to the convention with the explicit instructions of voting for that specific candidate, or are they able to vote for another candidate? Furthermore, how does one become a delegate? Well, I guess you sort of answered the question about explicit, because if they're explicitly for one candidate, they have to vote for that candidate in the first round anyway.
Assuming that candidate is still alive.
Still alive,
right.
And do they become free-for-all if the candidate is out of the race? Does the candidate tell them who they go to?
Well, look, Dick Gephardt has endorsed John Kerry, but Dick Gephardt does not control it. As a matter of fact, when Dick Gephardt got out of the race after his poor showing in Iowa, Gephardt specifically said, I will not give instructions to any delegates. They're free to do as they choose. His endorsement of Kerry was personal. But, I mean, the perfect example, and I've said this before, 1988, Dick Gephardt got 58% of the vote in the Missouri primary, but by the time he got to the convention, Dick Gephardt was no longer a candidate, and Michael Dukakis, the ultimate nominee, got an overwhelming majority of the Missouri delegates there. So, obviously, staying in the race helps, but usually, if you're pledged to a candidate in the primary, and that candidate remains through the convention, nominally, you are pledged for the first ballot.
What's it look like for tomorrow? I guess we're going to have, is it primaries in Tennessee and Virginia, two southern states, although Virginia, I guess, well, it's a southern state traditionally, although it's got, northern Virginia's got sort of a more northern mid-Atlantic feel to it. What's it look like for those two states?
Wesley Clark and John Edwards are campaigning heavily in those states. They say they do not have to win it to keep their candidacy alive, but again, The purpose of John Edwards' candidacy is to make the point that John Kerry cannot win in the South. I, John Edwards, can. But if John Edwards cannot win in two southern states, Tennessee and Virginia, then the question is, where can he win? Because he doesn't have a strong operation in Wisconsin. And again, if you don't win in the states you're supposed to win, do you have the money to go on? And the big test is on March 2nd when you have, 10-11 primaries. California, New York, Ohio, over 1,000 delegates, you need a lot of money, you need a lot of momentum to last that long, and if you don't win until then, it's hard to say hard to make the case that the campaigns continue.
And how long can candidates like Al Sharpton and Dennis Kucinich hold on in this circumstance?
These are two different Kucinich and Sharpton are different than Edwards and Clark in the sense that they are fighting for a cause. Just like we saw Jesse Jackson in 1988, just as we saw Pat Buchanan in 1996, they want to make a point. They stand for something that perhaps other candidates do not stand for. They do not need the money and the media attention that the other candidates do. They could go as far as the convention, and both Sharpton and Kucinich said that they will last as long as the convention.
So what do you think at this point? What is the smart money saying? I guess it has to be Kerry in the nomination.
It is, only because you see that, already there are matchups of John Kerry versus President Bush. The Newsweek poll, the CNN poll had Kerry with a slight lead. That is not shocking in the sense that all the attention has been on the Democrats right now, and President Bush has not made the case, or at least politically, campaign-wise, has not made the case the way the Republicans would like him to. But clearly, smart money, if we talk about smart money, Howard Dean, a few months ago, we were talking about whether Howard Dean would pick Wesley Clark as his running mate. I mean, those questions are long since gone. But having had 11 contests so far, having seen John Kerry with a big lead, it would be an unbelievable collapse, even far worse than Howard Dean's, for John Kerry not to get the nomination.
Thanks, Ken. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Joe.
Ken Rudin is NPR's political editor. He was with us here in Studio 3A. If you have questions about politics or political trivia to share, you can send email to Ken's Political Junkie column. That address is npr.org/politicaljunkie. And if you have questions, comments, or corrections about one of our programs, drop us a line. Our email is totn@npr.org. Please be sure to include the topic of the show in the subject line, tell us where you're writing from, and if necessary, give us guidance on how to pronounce your name. Talk of the Nation is produced by Susan Lund, Setsuko Sato, Justine Kennan, and Megan Williams. Chant Campbell directs the program. Brendan Banaszak is our production assistant, and Dustin Dwyer is the TOTN intern. Our technical director is Kevin Waite. Audio engineers include Vince Muse, Mitch Eaton, Manoli Wetherill, and Chris Nelson. Ellen Silva is our senior editor. Sue Goodwin is our senior producer. And the executive producer of Talk of the Nation is Leith Bishop. I'm Joe Palka in Washington.